We'll have a small class today. Hopefully we'll go a little bit. We have a wedding, and you're a guest of the wedding next soon. Let's are you up close? Okay.
Well, welcome. I've been a guest of the wedding, so we can get out.
Welcome to our church. We'll be in Luke chapter 2 primarily this morning. I'm just going to go over some very basic but often misunderstood things about the birth narrative. So before we begin, Jerry, I'm going to ask you to open us in prayer, please.
Thank you, Heavenly Father, again for this Christian and honor. It's great that you use God. Shares with us a little more on different aspects of the Christmas story that the Holy Spirit teaches. Give you the thanks and the strong name of your Son, Jesus Christ.
Thank you. There's one small piece and a very important piece that I want to just at least touch base on before we get into the Luke passage. And I would ask, that I'm going to want you to read because I believe it's better. I primarily read from the ESV, and that's where I'll be reading most of these texts.
What's the reference?
It's the part of the David and Hombush.
Oh, you're talking about
in chapter 2. Yeah, in chapter 2. But before that, I just want to mention there is a passage.
All right. I did want to make mention, because we kind of went through, started with the genealogies, and then we went to the announcement that Zechariah experienced, and then we skipped from there to Mary's announcement, and there's a lot in between that we're not really going to touch on. I just don't have time. So I'm kind of hit on a couple things. We're going to totally look at the birth narrative and how a lot of misconceptions, many, many misconceptions, that may or may not be have varying levels of accuracy, some which I can display and I think present a pretty good case are not accurate on some level. But there are a lot of things that are just assumed that I want to and kind of trace that back to why that is, where they came from. But I wanted to mention in brief, I'm not going to go through the text necessarily, but just what a remarkable figure, and maybe next year I can get into this, what a remarkable figure Joseph is. We don't know a whole lot about Joseph, but it clearly says that he was, you know, a just man. And I want to just make the comment about how the way he reacted with Mary and what he could have done. He could have just given, they could have thrown the book at her, they could have, you know, by right of Jewish law, she could have been stoned, put to death. And he bore shame in that, because there are aspects of, even though in the sight of those who would have understood that Mary, from their perspective, had a child out of wedlock, wouldn't put blame on him. Nevertheless, these marriages are so long forming, and so there's so much involved in bringing these families together, that this idea of this family, watch out, you don't want to get married to in this family. They really know how to choose them, right? So that's never going away. And he bears shame, and is humble. And I just wanted to make note of that when you read that, and the angel appears to him, he's still going to be struggling with that, even though he's been assured by the angel that, you know, this is all good, and then explains how it's all going to be okay, it's still going to be very difficult for them. And so he's a very remarkable character in the Bible, and I did want to make a brief mention of that. But let's skip into the text, Luke 2, 1 through 7. I'll start by reading in the ESV, and then when I need a special reference to that one verse, I'll ask you, Helen, to jump in. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. We'll stop there. So our Christmas narratives go something like this. After a long day of travel, Mary and Joseph finally arrive in Bethlehem. Joseph starts knocking on doors, and no one takes them in. Even the local motel is filled, has a no vacancy sign flipped over. And there's a nasty innkeeper who, after they persist rudely, shows them to an animal stable and leaves them with no help, and they have a child with no assistance, no one whatsoever, and they have to fend for themselves, and only the shepherds welcome them. Everyone familiar with this? Okay. Who sees anything wrong here or potentially wrong? So that's where we jump into this translation here. Why don't you go ahead and read that verse from the King James. King James and NAS.
Verse 6.
Yeah, verse 6.
And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered.
Okay. The idea there in the New American Standard follows suit, and some of the more like literal translations that aren't very colloquial, but they're accurate, kind of portray this. The word package sort of gets you to understand that they were there for a block of time. Okay, so I'm gonna unpack that a little bit. But yeah, these narratives, that's one item. There's another item in here that I want to address as well. That has to do with timing and their arrival and when they came, how long they were there. What else might seem a little strange?
Well, when the pastor tells the story in the sermons, he says that they went to a home where people lived, and the
exactly.
stables were attached, or underneath, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there must have been a whole family there.
Exactly. Exactly. That's so, in other words, the difference between a home that has animals in it and a public or a commercial inn where there would be a stable, and we'll look at an example where one of those is, even, and it's even in Luke's gospel. But those are the two main points. And from those points, there are other things that do connect to it. How would the shepherds be welcomed? Shepherds weren't. They were looked at. They had a list of the trades that the rabbinic crowd would urge you not to be a part of. One of them is shepherds. Shepherds were looked at as sinners because they had to take their flocks to nibble on food that belonged to other people. And so then they were stealing. And then how can they repent for what their animals have eaten? You know, it's just this long, tedious list of minutia, and that's so they were looked down upon. So if there was someone to be born as a king, they might feel like, well, if this is going to be a stately child, and how am I going to be welcomed into this home where no one would want me in their home because I'm a shepherd. So, and that's even addressed in the passage. So those are some of the elements that we want to look at, and. So there are several problems. One of them is with the night arrival idea. We don't know when they arrived, but the idea kind of, the way it's pieced together, and when you see it, whether it's filmed or animated or whatever, even on cards, this idea of them just swooshing in, and 15 minutes after they arrive, the baby's born, and it's this whole thing of panic, and no one's helping them, and everything's against them, and, you know, this is supposed to, like, build on the narrative of Christ, you know, adversity against Christ, and but the problem is just not there. It isn't there. We don't know. The baby could have been born in the daytime. I know people want to say that they want to have this thing be at night. They just want that to happen. You know, and then someone points to the star when it arose, and the star. Well, it doesn't say that the star rose when the baby was born. It just said, in fact, because they saw the star more than one time, right? They had to travel towards where they saw the star, right? But that's one of them, the late night arrival. And that came from a second century document. That's where at least where it originated from, called the Gospel of James. It's neither a true gospel in any sense that we would consider a gospel, it would be a gospel, and neither was James really, did he have anything to do with it. But it is a document that was circulated, and it had a lot of wild stories in it, and one of which was this nighttime birth account with a lot of strangeties in it as well. But this idea that that's where this came from, this whole nighttime narrative. And no one, and not many people helping them. So that's kind of where it started, and that has been regurgitated and changed and modulated with other things added to it. But it's not in the text. Neither is the idea of no one wanting to help them. So let's start there. Now we have to think a little bit like a first century Jew, which isn't easy for us because we, being from the Western world. And have, from Rene Descartes down, as a culture adopted the idea of I think, therefore I am. We have all this very isolated, individualistic view. We tend to, when we're thinking of things, we start with ourselves. Really, it's a very difficult mold for us to break out of. But when the first century Jewish person was looking at the community around them, they say, we are, therefore I am. They always have themselves placed within a community context. They make all decisions based on community. It's one of the highest communities of loyalty and honor that you'll ever find in the existence of this world. And that was true at that time. So a person is always a part of the community. It's very very easy for us to just think that this is a text with just a few people listed here. But if you look back, there are a lot of people that don't have names. I mean, first of all, the decree went out for everyone. This is a registration that was announced. And then it says, all went to be registered, each to his own town. So there's a lot of hustle and bustle of activity, a lot of people moving. And Joseph also went up. And also, it's interesting, Luke's writing to Theophilus, who is not a Jewish person, and he has to have some things explained to him. So when he says it's to the city of David, he then puts, there's a comma here, but which is called Bethlehem. He has to clarify that. If he was writing like Matthew was to a Jewish audience, he could have just left it at city of David. It would have been plenty. So not only are they going to Bethlehem, the city of David, but it is mentioned as being the city of David. And then he goes further and says, because he was of the household and lineage of David. Remember, it just said, each to his own town. He went to his back to his hometown. Literally, this is where he's from, to be registered with Mary, who was with child. And then while they were there, as was mentioned, the time came for her to give birth. And then there was no room for them in the inn. That's where we're going to go next. So you have a lot of people here, unnamed people. They're not just, it's not just them on their own, and they're all by themselves, and no one's going to help them. He went to friendly territory. So, and he even had other options if he needed them. I'll get to that in just a minute. But all he had to do is say, I'm so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. He could easily, and we looked at his genealogy 3 weeks ago, or 4 weeks ago, he would be able to explain who he was, what his bloodlines were. He had royal bloodlines. He was a royal, and that's significant here. It wouldn't take him long to identify himself to the people living in Bethlehem, the city of David. And also, if he was unable to secure a place, remember that just recently, Mary went and visited somebody. Do you remember who that was? Elizabeth. And where was she? In the hill country of Judea, it would be a half hour to an hour ride to Plan B, which would be, let's crash with Mary's, or with Elizabeth's people, and stay with that side of the family. So there was not just a Plan A, which he had a lot of relatives in the area, but he had Plan B, if you needed it. And so the idea that they didn't have a place to stay doesn't hold water. And also, you know, we have to also remember, we just mentioned, this place is filled with people traveling to register. So it makes sense that there are going to be guest rooms in these homes that are going to be taken. And it might be hard to situate everybody. But they'll make do. They'll figure it out. And it's also something, just to take a step back, Kenneth Bailey, one of the really, really good scholar who lived pretty much most of his entire life in the Middle East, various places, Egypt, Jordan, Jerusalem, and he taught from this perspective, specifically of the Middle Eastern culture in the first century. He's interviewed Coptic Christians and people that have loads of local information about how customs are and have been gone throughout the centuries, how customs have changed or where they have remained the same. And he said, you know what you should do is think about Amish people. Imagine people in Amish Pennsylvania. An Amish man shows up at an Amish farmer's door and says, my wife, we were traveling, my wife's having a baby, help, and to think that this Amish person is going to turn them down and say, no, here, go stay in the stable. Unthinkable. It's absolutely unthinkable. He said that would be a closer corollary, something that's close to us, familiar to us, but would be more like that. It's unthinkable that they would be turned down and not be given a place to be taken care of. So Joseph would have had some options, some places to stay. But also, you have to ask yourself, would Joseph be so stupid to, knowing that he had to be registered, and knowing that that had to happen by a certain time period, and that Mary's going to be in the end of her third trimester at around the same time, do you think he's not going to set this up in advance? Do we really think that of Joseph? After all we've learned about him, that's why I wanted to make the comment in the beginning, he's a righteous person. And he was a just person, and he took care of things. Everything is suggesting that he would have had this well planned in advance, maybe had one or two relatives to be able to count on for lodging, and you know that they'll figure it out. They'll figure it out. Or is he inept? Is he not capable? That's the other place you have to go. We have problems here if you think that this whole thing happens in a whirlwind. It just doesn't work. And if he's unable to take care of them, then what does Paul say about that when he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 5, verse 8? If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his own household, he is what? What is he? He's denied the faith, and he's worse than an unbeliever. Are we going to say that about Joseph? Is he that reckless and that idiotic that he can't just meet with some relatives and say, I'm going to be here around this time. Can you help me out? So, finally, the part where the shepherds come to visit. When it mentions that when they left, after they departed from their visit, what does it say that they were doing? Well, okay, I'm skipping forward. That's when they were alerted to the child being born. I'm saying after they, I should have clarified that. So they went and visited, I'm skipping forward. They went and they visited this child, and it said after they left that they did something. Okay. Now it says they went home praising God, but what does it say after that? There's a second part of that sentence. They went home praising God, for
shepherds return, glorifying and praising God for all the things, and then what Terry read, that they had heard and seen.
There you go. For all the things that they had heard and seen. That phrase right there. That does not work if the quality of the care is poor. It does not work if they are in a stable with a mean, nasty innkeeper that doesn't care, doesn't try to help in any way, shape, or form. If that happens, then the quality of the care is bad. They're not praising God for all that they have seen and heard. There's no way. That would be an abuse of language. So, obviously, that doesn't work. So they had to have noticed that, okay, they were taken care of. The shepherds had seen the situation, and all those things were in play. Mean innkeeper, stuck in a stable, manure everywhere. Joseph's frustrated, wringing his hand, I can't figure this out. Mary's crying, none of her relatives are there. If all that is happening, they're gonna say, come to our village. All right, our women will take care of you. We'll set you up. They're going to transport them immediately. In this culture, that's what they're going to do. This type of people, first century Jewish context. They would immediately say, let's figure out the easiest, safest way to transport you. We will take care of you. We can do better. They obviously leave saying, we can't do better. They've been given the best that they can have. So let's try to figure out then. I've been hitting this from a lot of different directions. Let's get to the inn idea and try to figure this out. Any questions before we head there? Okay. Two simple questions will get us there. What is the inn, and where was the manger? The word for inn here, translated inn here, is the word called kataluma in the Greek. And it can mean an inn. It can just mean a place to stay. Any place to stay whatsoever. And that can have a variety of contexts. Now, does this word appear elsewhere in the New Testament? And the answer is yes, it does. In fact, in the same gospel account, do you remember the story of the upper room where Jesus sends his disciples to go into the city of Jerusalem and find a man carrying a pitcher of water? And then he says, when he enters the house, ask the house owner, where is the kataluma? That's the upper room. So when Luke uses this word elsewhere, towards the end of this gospel, it is a house, a private home, clearly. Mark also, in his account of that instance, uses the same word. So there's only two instances. One is repeated in Mark as well as Luke. But only two instances in the New Testament of this word being used. It's been understood by many for a long time that this has been a public inn or a commercial inn. So we're going to look at why, put together some more information to help debunk that. So when Luke uses this word, he means guest room, attached to a private home. And does Luke have a word now, we must ask, for a commercial inn? And the answer to that is yes, he does. Any guesses where that might be? Does Luke have a word for a commercial inn? It's not kataluma, not this word that he uses in the birth narrative, and not the one that he uses when Jesus sends his disciples to find the upper room. Yeah. There is one, and when you think about it, it should jump right out. Yes, Good Samaritan. When he uses the word for inn during the parable of the Good Samaritan, the Samaritan takes the wounded man to the inn. It's pandokion, and the word literally means pan, like panoramic or pandemic, right? Widespread or all. And then the other part of the word, dokion, means to receive. All to receive, or to receive all. It's a house for all. Okay? It literally is what the word means. Public inn. It's a very common word. So common, this became, because of the admixture of languages and activity in the Middle East, this became a word that was transliterated into multiple languages. It was translated into Turkish, Armenian, Arabic, and Syriac. This word became a very, very commonly used word for the public inn that we find in the Good Story of the Good Samaritan. Now, why would Luke, who has this word available to him, a very common word that's very well used in that time, why would he not use that in the birth account if he meant a public commercial inn? That's the question you have to ask yourself. So now let's go a little further. That doesn't quite solve everything. We need to find out, question number two, where was the manger? And I guess to go there, let's find out a little bit more about what a house was like. What was the layout of a house? And this is where I wish I had a whiteboard, but I'll try to make it work. The simplest peasant home from the time of David all the way up until the Second World War was essentially a place with three zones, but largely one room. Okay, the house was essentially one large central room, and that's the room where the family cooked, it's where they slept, where they ate, they welcomed guests, etc. There was, at the end of that large room, a lower area. Think of the main area that I've just described as a raised terrace. At the end of that area, about 4.5 feet down, it's about 6 feet wide and 14 feet long, is a lower area, and that's where they would keep animals. It's large enough for a cow, which you needed for protein, for a donkey, which you needed for transportation, and for a few sheep from which you would make your winter clothing. So that's going to be at the end. So if you think of, you know, this raised section being kind of, not the whole section, but a large area, enough for a family to live in, and then it drops off. There's a little slope here. Then there's an area to keep your animals. And then there's a door to the outside and steps that go up to this raised terrace there where the family would live. There's a door, as I mentioned, at the lower end of the area. And at night, you'd bring the animals in. They'd been tied outside. You'd bring them in. That would provide warmth in the evening. And bringing them inside prevents them from being stolen. So in the morning, you open the door. The animals go back outside. You tie them up, clean up any droppings. Then at the evening, you bring them in. On the other end of the room is a roof, kind of like the prophet's chamber in Elijah that we find out. And that can be either it can either be an upper room, which is on the roof, or it can be adjacent to, but on the back end of the house as a separate room. But that's essentially those are the three areas. You have the animal area, the raised terrace where the family lives, that's the main big room, and then a guest room. In the Greek, it doesn't say no room at the end, as in a room like this is a room, and that's a room, and then that's a room. It doesn't say that. It says there was no space for them in the guest room. So literally, since there was no space for them, no room for them, no space for them in the guest room, that's because someone was staying there. And so the family would say, take the main quarters. It'll be better for you anyway. Now we're going to get to where the manger is. So what about this manger? As I mentioned, the animals are going to take residence at night. And we can't imagine anywhere in our culture for a manger to be except for in a barn. But if you have one large raised terrace room and you're keeping your animals in the building with you at night, you will, in the middle of the night, you don't want a cow in its hunger to start making noises and then wake everyone up. How do you solve that? Well, in the raised terrace area at the edge, this will be sloped a little bit so that it can be cleaned up, but you'll have carved out of the floor these little mangers, three or four of them. And they'll be deep enough where you can put some feed for the animals. And that way, in the middle of the night, they can get up and they can eat. And then in the morning, when you clean it up, it all falls down. You can sweep it out. You know, it's easy to clean. Now, in the Babylonian Talmud, we have mention of this type of building. And that's the body of Jewish civil and ceremonial law, the central text of rabbinic Judaism. Someone asked the question, can I take hay from under the bed and put it in the manger on Sabbath? Because doesn't everyone have hay under the bed? Well, they did. And if it's the Sabbath and then the animal starts to get hungry and it's hungry that day, they need to add more feed. Well, they should have taken care of that Friday before sundown. And now they're just going to have to deal with whatever the animal does, however cranky it gets. So that's how it goes. And then, so that's a description that validates this type of a household layout. Now, another instance is in the Old Testament. In 1 Samuel 28, in a passage where Saul he's with the medium or witch of Endor, and he's hungry. And how does it say he is fed? Anyone remember this? I'm not going to get into the details of the story, but it's in a home. We know that from the context. What's that? It says they slaughtered a calf from in the house. In order to cook it, in order to feed them. Now, everyone has a calf in their house, right? Don't we all? Well, they did. And so now we have some Old Testament, an Old Testament passage to kind of validate that. As I mentioned, the chamber in Elijah's story would also validate that. And here's the most striking one is this one. Remember the story of Jephthah in the book of Judges? What did he do? What was his... He went to fight a battle, and he made a vow. Does anyone remember that vow?
The first living creature that came to the house.
Out of the house, yep.
Out of the house.
In the morning, after the battle, right? If he was victorious, he's going to go home and show his thanks to God. He's going to offer a sacrifice. And it's going to be the first thing that emerges from the house. And then what happens? He's victorious. He travels home. And who comes out but his daughter? Now he has a tragedy on his hands. If there were no animals, no idea that there was going to be an animal coming out, then he's a murderer. I mean, is he hoping for his mother-in-law? I mean, where are you going to go? He was obviously expecting, what? The beginning of the morning, everyone slept, the animals have grazed some, and they have to be let out and tied outside, and they clean up, and the first thing to do is let the animals out. And that's not what happened. So, another New Testament context passage would be the light which is put on a lampstand, right? It's not put under a bushel. It's put on a lampstand and it gives what? Light to where? The whole house, everywhere. Now, what kind of house or what kind of home could you do that? I couldn't do that in my home. Now, there's a hallway, there's steps that go downstairs, and if I do light a lamp, it'll peek around. You'll see something of it, but it doesn't give light to all that are in the house because there's hallways, there's other rooms that are sectioned off. And again, that as I was mentioning about our individualistic culture, we have all these compartments in our homes. We can hide. We can go. This one big room where everyone stayed. So, even that passage when Jesus mentions that gives credence to this type of household layout. And then lastly, you have Jesus confronting, let's look at Luke chapter 13 real quick. Luke 13, verse 10. Now when he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a disabling spirit for 18 years. She was bent over and could not fully straighten herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her over to her and said, "Woman, you are freed of your disability." And he said, and he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day." And the Lord answered him, "You hypocrites. Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day?" Now, that presupposes that everyone had these animals that had to be untied. Then he calls them out. Are you to think that Jesus was that morning? He's like, I need to figure it out if this guy actually has a donkey or an ox. Let's go. And he's hiding in the bushes, and then they see him bring it out. He's like, "Okay, we got it. Let's heal this woman today, though." Now, you know, it's assumed. This is everyday life. This is how they live. And even this man had to untie his ox like everyone else does and lead it out. So hopefully, this provides you with a picture of what we are facing when we see the inn listed here, that there was no space for them in this guest room. If we can try to detune the idea of inn and try to replace in there the idea of guest room, I think we have a more complete picture here of what was actually, how this birth actually took place. Any questions or comments?
So, it's not the way we translate these verses into English that makes the confusion?
Somewhat. I mean, you look at Cataluma, when I broke down the other Pandokion, it means all to receive. It makes sense. And Cataluma doesn't have the same thing. We use words and they have an etymology with a very specific meaning, but they actually, you know, they connote something else. So the first word, the word for in, is more along those lines. It just means to untie, really. Luo is to tie, and kata is, so the idea is unpacking after you've traveled. So you go to a guest room. So it's more where you end up as opposed to what you actually are. So it's hard to translate that. They didn't have the word, I suppose, to say guest room the same way that we would want those words, when our language would want those words. So yeah, there's a little bit of difficulty. You find that a lot, in the Greek was the funny thing is it's the most precise language. It was at the time it was the most precise language. Alexander the Great conquered and brought so many different languages into, and a lot of Oriental customs got blended in with the Greek language. It made the language more precise, and which is really interesting that all happened before the gospel. Like the Greek language became more and more precise the closer you get to the events of the New Testament, making it the perfect language. There's been a really fascinating book, and part of the book addresses this. This one chapter is entitled "The Ungodly Preparation for the New Testament or for the Gospels," and how all these events beforehand sharpened the language and made it really precise. But we still find things that are very difficult to get a very clear translation the way our language would want it. Any other questions? I haven't looked in that a lot. I've heard passing little bits here and there. That's not an angle that I've really pursued.
Really
Maybe next year.
About,
yeah, I really wanted to get into the wise men. But I'm going to save that maybe next year. If we do this again, I'll get into that. That could be a whole Sunday morning in and of itself. But we have a few minutes left. There's really not further that I can go. I mean, I can answer questions. Yes. Oh, I see. Yeah.
It wasn't just Mary and Joseph.
Yeah. No.
Giving birth to the baby.
Joseph would not have been there. Yeah, likely his cousins, female cousins, and nieces and aunts, they would have been there. There would have been, and the village would probably likely have specifically very well experienced midwives, like people that really just give, that the community counts on these two or three women to deliver babies and deal with kind of like some of the difficulties that go on during birth. It's really interesting. We have so many children. I'm just sitting here going, yeah, well, how could I not be there? You know what I mean? It's a different context for me because I'm like, I love all the experiences that we've had with our children.
So, growing up, I had to sit around with all the sermons. Well, there's no space for the baby Jesus.
Yeah.
We have space in our church.
Okay.
So, given this new understanding of what we're talking about,
yes. So, yeah, so the idea that you're bringing is so the way that it's been made pastoral is to say, don't be uncaring, you know, or yeah, make space in your heart. But the idea of don't be unkind, right? Be better than these people. Well, the idea, you just flip it right around. These people gave everything they could. In this home, they gave them the main raised terrace near the animals, and it would be warm there. Maybe some of their children slept at the neighbor's next door. Whatever. They figured it out. They gave them the absolute best they could, which is validated by the shepherds, praising God for all that they had seen and heard. So the pastoral note there is give your best all the time, especially those in your household, which is what I quoted from in the pastoral epistle there. Right. It wasn't the most appropriate. No, he should have. Yeah, they should have taken him into the palace. But, you know, that wouldn't have gone over well since, you know, that's not a... especially not with Herod looking for the child. Probably it was best that they were in private quarters. And we see how that, in the ensuing days, how that played out. So, any other questions or comments? I'm told to kind of break this off right around now-ish, but we got about 2 or 3 minutes. Anything else? Any other comments? Questions?
Thank you.
Oh, it's my privilege. I enjoy it. Thanks to Pastor for giving me the opportunity to do this. It's always a joy for me to do the study and can just kind of dig into this stuff. So, all right. Well, Terry, will you please close us in prayer?
Thank you, Heavenly Father, for studying during the month of December about the Christian story and the different aspects of God. Just thank you that you have everything planned out in your bells. Your Son became flesh and blood among us. That was the beginning of our gift that keeps on giving. Being the second service, filling the area.